Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, listener mail. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we're bringing you the messages that you have sent to us. To start us off today, we've actually got a straggler that I think was originally sent like last September or October, but as we mentioned on the show a few times, I think we lost some mail from that period. Something happened to it. And so Carolyn resent this one. You want to start with this one, Rob?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, this is from Carolyn about the Leshy. You remember the creature of the forest in Russian mythology. Carolyn says, "Hi, Robert and Joe. I just finished your episode on the Leshy. Once you described the creature, I kept expecting you to bring up similarities it has with the wolf in the Little Red Riding Hood tale. I had never heard of this creature before, but that was the first thing I associated it with. You mentioned one of its usual forms is that of a wolf, and that it likes to lead unwary travelers off the path. Other parts of the character that seemed to correspond were: when it disguises itself as the grandmother, there is something off, and Little Red Riding Hood's mother specifically warns her not to talk to strangers or stray from the path. Could the wolf in this tale be a version of the Leshy that traveled from the folk tales of Russia to the folk tales of Germany? Regardless, from now on I'm going to think of the wolf from that tale as a Leshy in disguise. It makes a lot more sense as a Leshy than as a random wolf interested in a quick two-course dinner, Carolyn." Well, Carolyn, this is an interesting idea. I don't know if it would go exactly as direct a line as that. Like, you have Leshy, and then that turns into the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood. But I can absolutely see that this could come out of similar myth or folktale archetypes that are kind of banging around throughout folktales of the whole world, actually. Because I remember reading in the past that the Little Red Riding Hood folktale is thought to sort of be influenced by mythemes or bits of stories and story elements that you find all throughout the world. You find all throughout the folk tales of ancient Europe, in North Africa, even in Asia. So it seems to be one of those things that's kind of a stew of different elements that you can find in bits and pieces from myths going way, way back.
Yeah, I mean, Robert Frost was right about one thing. The woods are deep and they are dark. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has – a lot of things have crept out of that imagined darkness in human myth-making and legend over time. So I feel like these two creatures, even if there's not any real connective tissue, they both emerge from that same darkness.
Yeah. I seem to recall that – I don't know if this is actually a legitimate connection, but I seem to recall there's some kind of idea that there's like a very ancient myth archetype about like a fire maiden, like a young woman or girl who is somehow associated with fire or redness in a way, who is attacked by a wolf and then rescued by a hero of some kind. And then that, I think, is also paired somewhat with the classic sort of restoration from the dead or restoration from the belly myth part that you get in the story of Jonah being swallowed by the whale and then spit back out. But you can even get in directly in Russian folktales where mm-hmm. somebody's eaten by a wolf and then survives after being cut out of the belly.
Yeah.
All right, we got another one. This is also, a straggler, but as we always say, stragglers are welcome. This goes back to our episode on fingernails, and it comes from Sicily. Rob, do you want to read this one?
Sure, here we go. This is what it says. "I am a new listener and am currently listening to your two-part episode from September 2020 on fingernails. I am someone who regularly has enhanced with hard gel or acrylic very long fingernails. I attached a picture for reference. You asked for stories about living with long nails, and I thought you might be interested to know that tool use and knuckle use are important for success. There are very few things I cannot do with long nails, and mostly turn my knuckles into fingertips to do things like pop soda tabs or remove contact lenses." Now, that's impressive. As a contact wearer, I have never attempted to use my knuckles to get them out. I guess it's possible.
Wait, which knuckle? Would it be your first knuckle or second knuckle?
I don't know. I'm just imagining all knuckles. Maybe I'm envisioning it wrong, but I'm just imagining just going in there, just like 10 knuckles and removing the contact lenses.
You know, it would be a really interesting cyberpunk enhancement would be fingertips on your knuckles. So you get like separate finger pads extending out from, I guess, your first, your large knuckle.
Have I seen that before? I feel like I've seen something like that. Maybe not cyberpunky, but something like fleshy, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It rings a bell. Anyway, they continue. Tools like tweezers can be helpful for things you might use the edge of your nail for. Certain styles of common objects are also more nail-friendly, like a keyboard with flat, thin keys to allow typing with finger pads instead of fingertips, though I still often use pencils with erasers to type on other types of keyboards. The hardest routine task I encounter is actually putting an earring back onto an earring, as the nail tends to get in the way of both a very small object and a very specific motor movement.
Hmm. Oh, maybe that's supposed to be putting an earring on an ear.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I could see that being difficult.
Yeah.
Anyway, they continue. An additional layer to note about nails is that there is a tendency, at least for me, to try to use them as tools, but doing so will cause them to break despite fortification. So much of the tool and knuckle use is not because I cannot do the task with nails, but rather to preserve their integrity. Lastly, I enjoyed hearing the supernatural / scary aspects of long nails that you described in your episode, because I specifically like having long pointy nails that reference demonic or witchy aesthetics. I'm greatly enjoying the episodes I've heard so far, and I'm excited to keep listening. Thanks, Cicely.
Well, Cicely, welcome on board. We hope you keep enjoying, and thanks for sharing your experience with long nails. I'm glad to hear that you are specifically trying to be demonic or witchy.
You know, I was just appreciating nails the other day because I was working on some miniatures, and you know, I use like a little file, and I use a little razor blade to remove unwanted portions of the plastic. But then there are times where I realize, you know what works better than either of these fine instruments? The fingernail itself. You know, it's like fingernails are just so useful for fine manipulation, often in ways that we just take for granted.
I don't know how gross to get on the show here, but I think some people would say that fingernails are sort of like perfect tools for pimple popping.
Perfect, grimy, disease-ridden tools.
Yeah. Ugh, yeah, that can lead to some skin infections, I bet. Mm-hmm. Wait, I guess a pimple already is a kind of skin infection, right? Or am I right about that? I don't really know. I guess we'll have to sort that out later. Okay, next we've got a short message about the bonsai episode where we talked about Tate's Hell, the forest in Florida where the dwarf cypress grow. And this is a short message from Sammy. She says, "Hello there, guys. I have been in the Florida panhandle my whole life, which would be 35 years. I knew not of this Tate and his personal hell that is a Florida forest, so thank you guys for bringing it to my attention. I've Googled it and live about an hour and 45 minutes away, so now I have a new place to take my son camping. No, don't do it, Sammy." He will have fun with the name. If nothing else, thank you, Sammy. I'm sure it's safe these days if you know, have navigation devices and all
that.
Yeah,
it's more Tate's heck these days.
This next message comes to us from Mark, and it is about our episode on gold. I guess I'm going to read this one because, Rob, after this, there's some about Avatar The Last Airbender, and I assume those are your territory.
Okay.
Mark says, "Hi, Robert and Joe. Huge fan of your podcast. My favorite bits are when you connect the central topic to some other esoteric piece of knowledge deep in the recesses of your minds. When the pandemic is over, you should have a contest to win lunch with Robert and Joe. I expect the conversation would lead to some interesting places." Well, that's very nice of you to say, Mark, but I suspect I am much more boring in person.
My wife and son have been winning that contest every day for over a year now. And they would prefer to watch episodes of Avatar during lunch. So take that for what it's worth.
Mark goes on. "In your gold medal episode, you talked about how gold did not have many practical applications beyond its use as jewelry or coinage, and then later in electronics and medicine. But the studious high school chemistry student in me would be remiss to forget Rutherford's gold foil experiment." Ah, this is great to bring up. So Mark writes, "At the time of the experiment, scientists did not know the structure of the atom. We know today that it consists of negative electrons orbiting a positive nucleus of protons and neutrons. Back then, after the electron was discovered, someone theorized the, quote, plum pudding model, which conceived of the electrons surrounded by a field of positively charged plums. Rutherford's experiment was to shoot an alpha particle beam through a thin piece of gold foil and see what happened to the particles. The result was that the particles deflected off at sharp angles, some even bouncing backwards. From this, he deduced that the positive charge was not spread out around the electrons, but rather packed into a tight, compact nucleus. So why was gold used? Because it was so soft and malleable, they could compress it into an extremely thin layer. In an ideal experimental state, the foil would only be one atom thick. Obviously, this was not possible, but they got it thin enough. Thanks for all the great episodes. Keep them coming, Mark.
Well, thanks for pointing that out, Mark. That's a great historic example to bring up.
Awesome. Yes. Now, we're about to get into some Avatar The Last Airbender content, because I think in the gold episode, we ended up talking about gold bending in Avatar. So if you have no idea what this stuff is about, I will try to be your avatar in the conversation.
All right. Yeah, we received some Avatar listener mail from, I think, three or four different people, but we have two of them included here. So this one comes to us from Emily. Hi, Robert and Joe. I'm a longtime listener, and I am very grateful for the many hours of learning and entertainment you've provided me. I also love the new Weird House Cinema episodes, so thank you so much for that. I reached out to my Avatar Legend of Korra superfan friend Andy with your question about metal benders bending gold. This was her response. In the scene where Kuvira crushes the Kyoshi Medal of Freedom during Prince Wu's coronation, you can see from the coloring of the medal that there is likely gold in it. Additionally, when looking at the royal brooch, one can see it is meant to be gold, which would signify that royal artifacts in the Earth Kingdom have a large gold component. It would also be reasonable that if metal benders are able to bend meteorites, that there would be nothing stopping them easily bending a soft metal such as gold. Hope this is interesting to you. Keep it up, Emily in Vermont.
Okay, Rob, can you explain the context here? What's this about?
This was, so I watched this episode not too long ago when we were going through the Legend of Korra. And yeah, it's basically someone who has the metal bending ability. They crush something that has gold in it. But so yes, that's a good example from the show. But then we also heard from a listener named Hannah, and she points out something even more on point here. So Hannah writes in and says, I was so excited when you mentioned Avatar, The Last Airbender, in your latest episode on gold. I'm a huge fan of Avatar, The Last Airbender, and consider it one of the most formative pieces of media in my life. I was smack dab in its target age group. I think I was 10 or 11 when it premiered on Nickelodeon and watched every episode when it aired. I have since, at various points, rewatched the entire series three or more times as I got older, as well as watching The Legend of Korra twice and reading all the comics. Watching it as a child, I just love the epic plot, exciting fights, and fun humor. Coming back to it as an adult, however, I'm able to appreciate how well-developed the characters are and how nuanced the treatment of some heavy subjects are, like war, imperialism, genocide, and grief, especially how they impact children and families. I always appreciate media that treats its young audiences as the intelligent beings that they are and knows that kids can handle complex and challenging subjects if they're presented with enough patience. Anyway, the real reason I wanted to write in is that I think I know why we never see any earthbenders bending gold. I'm going to avoid as many spoilers as possible. Metal bending is invented in Avatar The Last Airbender by an extremely powerful earthbender who realizes that because metal is, quote, earth that has been purified and refined, they can use their unique ability to see the impurities left in the metal and bend that. By the time of Avatar Legend of Korra, 70 years later, metal bending as a technique is far more widespread. In this series, it is revealed that metal benders cannot bend platinum, as it is too pure, and there are not enough trace amounts of earth for them to detect and bend. Given the associations of gold and purity, I think it would not be bendable in the same way that they treat platinum in the universe of the show. I cannot possibly gush enough about Avatar, so I'll end by mentioning the fun fact that each bending style is inspired by different real-life martial arts. For example, water bending is based on Tai Chi. I remember as a child seeing the short behind-the-scenes snippet during ad breaks on Nickelodeon where the martial arts consultants of the show would explain why certain styles were chosen, with side-by-side comparisons between the animated scenes and himself demonstrating the movements in real life. It was really interesting and beautiful. Anyway, thanks so much for the podcast. I always look forward to it showing up in my feed.
Oh, well, thanks so much, Hannah. Okay, so this this raises more questions for me. So the idea is that the natural earthbender person in the show can manipulate earth in like a telekinetic type way. Is that basically it? But the earth must mean something than just like any solid material that comes out of the ground, because of course, you know, gold and platinum would be metals that can be found in the earth. So what is the actual earth that can be bent, and what are the kind of impurities you're looking for in gold or platinum in order to bend it?
Well, I mean, basically, the main earth bending you see is just like rocks, you know, like causing the rocks in the earth, whatever minerals happen to be there, and using those, like making shields rise up, you know, throwing rocks at people with it, that sort of thing. And, you know, it gets really elaborate. And later you see people using like stone constructs as well. Yeah, the idea here is, I guess, that perhaps gold in and of itself is just too pure to bend. You need something with, if you're going to bend a metal, it has to have impurities in it. So you're actually bending the impurities or using the impurities as kind of the handle by which you you bend the other material. In a similar way, there's a variety of water bender that pops up called a blood bender, where, and it's, you know, this is like the dark side of water bending, where you can manipulate a human being by bending the water in their body. So you're not bending the human, you're bending the water in their flesh. And this is, would be similar. You bend the metal by bending the impurities in the metal.
Oh, it's like that thing we already mentioned, the scene in X-Men 2 where somebody gets injected with a bunch of iron in their blood and then Magneto messes with them.
And, you know, hey, if you go with the theory of gold's origin, of it being ultimately extraterrestrial in nature, maybe you can heap that in there as well. You know, it's like you're an earthbender, not a, you know, space mineral bender.
Okay, so I just looked it up. I was trying to find what are the main elemental impurities that are found in high purity gold. And according to a paper by DJ Kinneberg called Origin and Effects of Impurities in High Purity Gold in 1998, the majority of the impurities in gold were silver, followed by iron, copper, and lead. So maybe if you're trying to bend gold, you're looking for one of those things. I mean, I'd imagine if you're an earthbender and you can move rocks around, probably one of the things you can move is iron, right?
Yeah, I would imagine so. So anyway, interesting to think about it all, and to sort of it's always interesting exercise to take the world of fiction and magic and then compare it with the world of metallurgy and see where you go.
Okay, this next message comes from Sophie, and it is a follow-up from a previous email she sent about our episodes on head and brain theft. Now, in Sophie's original email, she compared the repeated student prank theft of Jeremy Bentham's nasty jerky head to something called the Gavel Goat. We didn't know exactly what that was offhand, and were forced to do some rapid Googling, but she follows up on that subject. So Sophie says, "Dear Robert and Joe, all that time agonizing over sentence phrasing and making my contextual sidebars easy to cut around for anecdote shortening, and not once did I think, hang on, they might not know what that is, memory is so faulty, facepalm. The Gavel Goat in Sweden, aside from seeming like a lovely annual tradition, has organically gained an unasked-for tradition where the large goat raised for Advent in Gavel, Sweden, gets burned down or otherwise destroyed nearly every year." She attaches a couple of articles. Basically, it's become an embedded arms race between people trying to fireproof and protect the statue while others attempt to destroy it to extreme lengths, involving cameras, flaming arrows, confused foreigners. I don't know what all those references are, but she goes on, "The fact that it's illegal vandalism does little to challenge the fact that it's now an organically established sociocultural phenomenon. Once it becomes a globally known thing, watched annually to see what protections are added or how long it lasts, it's much harder to stop. Thus, what I meant to reference was the fact that if stealing Jeremy Bentham's head became a routine occurrence with momentum behind it, like the unintentional tradition of burning the lovely goat has, it goes from an aberrant side note slash periodic problem to a constant battle that begins to feel inevitable, and likely one that University College London wishes to avoid, unless, of course, Bentham had some sort of expressed wish somewhere that he would like his head to be periodically stolen. That would be wild. Anyways, with the opportunity to once again compliment you on your work, your Friday features are the closest I will ever come to being able to watch many of your favorite movies, like horror films. But I get to hear you talk about things with passionate enjoyment and better wrap my head around the cult-important yet mystifying Troll 2, Sausage Man, Synthetic Flesh.
Synthetic Flesh.
And assure you that I'm not holding my breath on a website and writing this from the grave. But you can't receive that for which you do not politely ask, no? Pretty sure I still have my head and brain and everything. Already, this looks so much longer than it felt in my head, so I shall away lest I conceive more syllables. Hope y'all are safe and well as that looks for you, Sophie.
Well, I have to say, I don't think there's really a cult following behind Sausage Man.
No, I think that's just us.
Yeah, just us. But hey, maybe the cult is growing. Maybe we have three members of the cult now.
I've never heard anybody else really make much cult reference to Synthetic Flesh either, weirdly, because it seems like that should inspire...
You'd think, like we were saying, that should be... DJ should be dropping that sample like crazy, I would think.
Synthetic Flesh. Synthetic Flesh. Synthetic Flesh.
DJ Carney.
But then again, even if the... Even if the actual phrase "synthetic flesh" and that line from the film isn't worshipped, I feel like that's the use of special effects in that film definitely influenced a lot of people. So at least the spirit of synthetic flesh has traveled far.
Troll 2 absolutely has its own organic cult following, but I think Sausage Man is all stuff to blow your mind.
All right, this next one comes to us from Justin. This one says, hello, Rob, Joe, and Seth. I have been listening for approximately 5 years now, and this is my first time writing in. I have really enjoyed the new format. I realize it takes a lot of effort for everyone on the Stuff to Blow Your Mind team to pull together and put out quality content consistently, but you really have been and continue to deliver the goods each day and every day. But I must insert that I was perfectly fine with how it was before. As a consumer, your program has truly become a five-course meal. I enjoy having a listener mail episode to kick the week off. It adds a real-time element and offers a consideration on the perceptions of the audience with the topic, while the topic is still fresh in my mind. While many of the listeners can offer expertise on subjects covered, I do not have anything new or exciting to offer at this time, and that's okay, I think. I figure my input is just as valuable. I was concerned when Invention was absorbed. Invention episodes are a delight, and I'm happy to see core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind include Invention. I feel that the Artifact episodes show off your writing skills. I would say your conversational tone has been what keeps me listening, and Artifact episodes might lack that tone, but have the same DNA incorporating curiosity and wonder, all the while acknowledging some topics are short and sweet. Weird House. I was talking with my wife about this new portion. She mentioned that it seems like this show is tailored specifically for me. I happen to love movies found off the beaten path. I have often called them winners. I have a few personal favorites I would love for you to explore. Redline. If you only cover one animated feature, consider this film. Creatures, Speedsters, An Invasion. I've watched this movie with the same group of friends several times, and I am always in awe. Funky Boy Awoken on Robo World. I don't know how to explain this movie. It's like a mashup of tropes and pop culture with an excellent artistic direction. Dr. Otto and the Riddle of the Gloom Beam. I stumbled upon this. It plays off the zany characters developed by Jim Varney, a.k.a. Ernest. A low-budget sci-fi delight. It hits all the weird notes. Lastly, I must sing of praise and admiration. You folks are my travel companions and always lift my spirits. You should know how much your work and your integrity means to me and my fellow listeners. Often your work is the best part of my day. Thank you.
Oh, well, that is far too kind, Justin. Thanks for getting in touch.
You know, we appreciate the feedback. And thanks for bringing Redline to my attention. It was totally off my radar. But after watching a clip, I actually ordered a copy of this because it looks absolutely insane. So I don't know yet if it's definitely Weird House material, but I'm looking forward to checking it out on my own at the very least. As for Dr. Otto, I've never seen it, but I grew up watching all the Ernest movies, of course. And weirdly enough, I was childhood friends with director, Ernest director and co-creator John R. Cherry III's nephew. And so I remember distinctly he had some, his nephew had some art on his wall in his room that his uncle had drawn or painted for him. And I remember it was like, you know, weird, almost kind of psychedelic art. It was pretty neat.
Wow, I just looked up the VHS box for Dr. Otto, and it is alive. Is this also, so it looks like Jim Varney as Ernest on the cover in like a little box, maybe just showing you like, hey, remember Ernest? It's this guy. But then the bigger picture is, I think also Jim Varney, but more in a kind of psychedelic Elvis look.
Yeah, he had several characters that he played. You know, he did the Ernest character, he had an old woman character, and then this Gloombeam character who, it was like him as some sort of maniacal, you know, creature with a hand on the top of his head. It seems like I saw that character pop up on some TV show or another when I was a kid as well.
You know what? He looks like a character who could fit in Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, probably so. Varney was a great performer. I enjoyed him in pretty much everything I saw. Mostly it was Ernest films, though. And I do remember Ernest Scared Stupid as being quite enjoyable, at least when I was a child.
I got to confess, I think I was scared by that movie.
It had some legitimately scary stuff in it. As I recall, it's been a long time, but there's some sort of troll creature that is the central threat is like legitimately a bit scary.
I think that it could turn people into wood by looking at them.
Oh.
And that prospect scared me. I did not want to be turned into wood.
Yeah, it delivered more horror than an Ernest film had to, you know. But I guess it was, you know, for creators, like that was probably, you know, one of the things. It's like if you're going to make just a whole bunch of Ernest movies in your career, when you do a Halloween one, like that's your excuse to let loose and fit in as much like horror stuff as you possibly can. So I applaud them for that.
Okay, now we got some straight-up Weird House Cinema messages. So this first one comes from Brenda. Brenda says, hello, just listen to your Ghost in the Machine episode. Remember, that was the 90s cyberpanic one that was like the haunted computer movie. And Brenda says, was wondering if Johnny Mnemonic from 1995 would be a movie you would consider for Weird House Cinema. It's based on a William Gibson story with a cast including Keanu Reeves, Dolph Lundgren, Ice-T, and Henry Rollins. And don't forget the Yakuza, a must at the time for futuristic cyberpunk, and Jones, a military-trained dolphin, and it's set in 2021. Thank you and stay well. Saying be well is a little too Demolition Man, Brenda.
Well, you know, I've never seen Johnny Mnemonic, though I'm well aware of it. I mean, it was based on a William Gibson short story, as I recall. And yeah, it's loaded with fun performers. So I don't know. Maybe we'll check it out. It takes place this year. So this would be the year to do it.
I guess so. Oh, and then by serendipity, right around the same time, maybe even the same day, we got another note from a listener about Johnny Mnemonic. This one was from Chris. Chris says, hi, Robin Joe. Queued up quite the interesting film this evening on Prime. I'm a big Keanu Reeves fan, but had never seen Johnny Mnemonic. Not sure if it's weird enough, but it's quite interesting as there is a strange 90s mashup of technology. There is talk of sending faxes, having a brain capacity of 320 gigabytes, and some sort of device that looks like a mini CD player. Remember those? There is a wild device that looks sort of like a laser floss that can cut through anything. There's a cutscene of a Concorde jet landing. Dina Meyer, who plays, a character named Jane, has a quite manic energy during some moments. Oh, and Dolph Lundgren is in this movie. There's a dolphin that can scan sound waves, and Keanu refers to it as a fish. To be honest, I feel bad for the dolphin. Ice-T shows up as a character. Well, it's really something else. Best, Chris.
Well, there you go. I mean, it sounds like we should probably add it to the list. We've got enough people asking for it.
Yeah. Oh, and one last thing. Chris also wrote to us like right around the same time to say that they were going to watch Boggy Creek 2. And they said, thank you for always expanding my horizons.
That's what Boggy Creek 2 does. It expands horizons.
It's about learning.
Yeah. All right. Here's another one. This one comes to us from Wonko. Wonko writes in and says, "Hello, Robert and Joe. I was getting caught up on this week's cast and listening to Weird House Cinema episode on Demon Knight. I was struck with inspiration to write in. You mentioned that each successive chosen one adds their blood to the key and possibly dilutes the blood of Christ in the process. But many Christian faiths believe that when normal water is added to holy water, then it too becomes holy. Perhaps the chosen one's blood is similarly transubstantiated when added. Thank you for everything, Wonko."
Ah, this is a very good point. Yeah. So like the thing in the movie is that Billy Zane, I guess, is trying to pour all of the Christ blood out of this bottle key thing. It's the MacGuffin in the movie. Mm-hmm. And somehow the chosen ones, which originally is William Sadler, the guy who's doing like naked martial arts in his hotel room in Die Hard 2. Mm-hmm. And then later Jada Pinkett, they put their blood in there. And I guess that somehow mixes with the blood of Christ. And yeah, it does some kind of magic. But this is a good point, though. I wonder if, like, by that logic, if the holy thing always like spreads its holiness basically infinitely by almost the principle of like homeopathic medicine, you know, things can just be like infinitely diluted. If it works like that, why couldn't you just like pour a drop of holy water into the ocean and then make all the water on earth holy?
I don't, because it eventually runs into fish pee. I don't know.
Would that not have the, would the holy water not have the power to overcome the pee-ness?
I don't know. Or maybe any animal that's not specifically mentioned in the Bible, if the holy water encounters its urine, then it stops. I don't know. You know, maybe there's a range of effect, you know, it's like Dungeons and Dragons. We'd have to look at the spell, the exact text of the spell, and go by that.
You know, this raises a good issue I was just wondering about the similarities between Dungeons and Dragons and constitutional law. And that, yeah, like, could you have like similar philosophy styles? Like, are there Dungeons and Dragons strict constructionists versus original intent versus like living document?
I guess, you know, I guess the thing is, in Dungeons and Dragons, you always have that dungeon master. Their word is the final word.
I guess that also has theological connections, right? Like, that's the debate between sola scriptura versus like, does the church have a say?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, ultimately, the bottom line is ask your dungeon master, because they are the divine will on earth.
They are your pope. All right, this next message comes from Dan, and it is also about Tales from the Crypt Demon Knight. Dan says, and this is a Crypt Keeper reference, so I'll try to do the voice. Hello, kiddies.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Oh, was it? Okay. Yeah. Dan says, hello, kiddies. I'm writing in regarding your Weird House Cinema episode on Demon Knight. I never knew that it was a feature film that played in theaters and always thought it was a made-for-TV movie due to the fact that it was a Tales from the Crypt production, and I first watched it on HBO back in the late 90s. Personally, I thought the title never really fit, as Billy Zane is less a knight and more like a drifter or hitchhiker. It is a movie with a very high drifter quotient. Mm-hmm. Dan goes on, still, I enjoyed it. I'm glad that you decided to cover Demon Knight and not Bordello of Blood, because that movie, even by late 90s horror standards, is terrible. Why would anyone ever cast Dennis Miller as the snarky protagonist in a horror movie? Quick fun fact regarding Demon Knight. I remember watching an interview somewhere with Jordan Peele, who was asked his favorite final girl, and he said it was Jada Pinkett and Demon Knight. Loving the Weird House Cinema episodes, favorite Dick Miller roles are in The Howling, Gremlins, and Terminator. Dan. Oh, Dan. Well, this was a great bit. And somehow this fact about Jordan Peele seemed familiar to me. I wasn't sure if we had mentioned it in the episode, but I assume not, since you brought it up in the email here. So I looked this up. I found the actual video. It's apparently an interview with the Wall Street Journal, which seems like a kind of strange venue for Jordan Peele to discuss his thoughts about horror as a genre. But it was a good interview where they were asking some kind of quick, direct questions about like his favorite examples of things in horror. And he was giving his answers. And there are some write-ups you can find on the internet, like articles that summarize it. But I just wanted to talk about a few of the things he says. Oh, and by the way, I guess I should just say, yeah, I'm a big Jordan Peele fan. I love Key and Peele. It's one of my favorite comedy shows of recent years, and Jordan Peele's horror movies are really good.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyway, on the subject of horror, he talks about how the first movie that scared him was The Fly.
Excellent.
And he says that it scared him because he watched it at an age that was really inappropriate. I think he's talking about the David Cronenberg Fly, not the one with Vincent Price. And so,
that would mess you up. That would mess you up.
Not a movie for kids to see. I don't know who should see that. I mean, like, I respect that movie, but fun for no ages.
Yeah, that's like with me. I saw RoboCop way too early, and it's just like, oh my God, really, really bit off more than I could chew with that.
But he also talked about a thing with reference to The Fly that's something I definitely feel. He says, you know, part of what's good about horror is that, like, he said he watched The Fly and it really messed him up, like it scared him. But then once it was over, he got through it and he was less scared because he'd made it to the end. And it does give you a kind of feeling of mental fortification to, like, make it through a simulated scary experience in a horror movie and then you come out the other end safe.
Yeah.
But he also talks about how his favorite musical score from a horror movie is Nightmare on Elm Street. I think that's a good choice. Yeah.
I don't remember it at all. I would not go in that direction. I'd obviously go with you know, some sort of Carpenter score, I imagine.
Yeah, I lean very much on Carpenter for horror scores. But no, the Nightmare on Elm Street theme is good. It's a do 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 do. You know? No? Okay.
Vaguely. Yeah.
He says his favorite B-horror movie is Critters.
Oh, that's so good. That's on the potential list for Weird House. Critters is good.
I need to revisit Critters. I basically don't have memories of this movie. I think I've only sort of half watched it.
Yeah, I mean, it's another Gromlin movie, so we got to get in there.
He says the scariest horror villain is Michael Myers because he says he's not even evil. He's just curious. Which I see what he's saying about that, but that's funny because that's a direct contradiction to what Loomis repeats over and over in Halloween and the whole series. The evil has escaped. He's the evil.
Why are you not listening to me, Jordan Peele?
There is one part where he's asked to assemble an Avengers-style team of horror villains. This is a really good mix. He says, okay, Freddy Krueger, Candyman, the Silver Ball from Phantasm, Chucky from the what's the doll movies, Child's Play, and one of the Graboids from Tremors. Now that is a team.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I guess I could go with that. Yeah.
Come on, that's funny. Only three of them talk. And
well, yeah, and you know Freddy's gonna do most of the talking. Well, I don't know. Chucky and Freddy both really talk a lot. So
yeah.
It's gonna be mostly them with the silver ball kind of going around in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, but then the last thing is that, yeah, in that interview, Jordan Peele absolutely does say that he's asked his favorite final girl, and he says Jada Pinkett and Demon Knight. He says that she was the first black final girl that he could remember from a horror movie, and he identified with her. I think she's a great choice. I mean, Demon Knight, as we've said, is pretty wonderful.
It's a solid horror flick, and it also goes to show, you know, the representation matters, you know, having diversity in your cast matters because people are watching this and they're growing up. We shouldn't get our entire view of reality from horror films, but like that's part of the media we consume, you know?
Yeah, the characters of horror films are not usually, I don't know, aspirational figures or role models, but B-horror is a genre where, I don't know, admirable levels of diversity are still not often achieved.
Right, absolutely. Here's a question, though. What would an Avengers-style team of horror villains like this, what would they be trying to achieve? Why would they come together? Like, what would they be opposing?
I imagine it's like Suicide Squad or something, right? Like, we've got an even badder. I mean, I've never seen Suicide Squad. What I assume the plot of Suicide Squad is we've got a villain who's so bad they can only be defeated by people who are themselves bad.
Hmm. Oh, man, what if it become? You could do it as like a generational thing, like there's a super team of boring modern horror icons, you know, so it's like Ghostface and Jigsaw. I don't know. I realize those are probably not modern anymore, but it's like those guys, that generation of horror villains, and opposing them, the previous generations of horror villains. So it's like generation versus generation. Who's going to win?
Okay, actually, we just got a suggestion from Seth about what the modern horror icons are. These are good. I couldn't think of them. So you got Annabelle from the Annabelle movies, that messed up doll. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, I hate that thing. I tried to watch one of those movies. It was awful. And then the guy from Sinister, which I also have not seen those movies, but Seth compared him to a member of Slipknot. And I think that's appropriate. That's exactly what he looks like.
Now, they're all from the same universe, right? Is that the Conjuring universe that I've heard talk of?
Well, Annabelle is the Conjuring universe. I don't think the Sinister guy is. I think he's just New Metal Demon universe.
Okay. All right. I'm just not up enough on my current horror, I think.
Okay. But anyway, so those are the villains. And then you need a team, like a cracked Avenger-style team of traditional horror movie monsters, demons, and ball technology to go up against them.
All right. Sign me up.
Okay. Phantasm Ball versus Blair Witch. How about it, right? The question is, does the ball get lost in the woods? It's zooming around, but is it zooming in circles?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give it a shot. All right. Well, I guess we're going to go ahead and put a stake in this one as well. This is your weekly listener mail, but we'll be back next week, most likely, with more listener mail. So keep it coming if you have thoughts on content from this episode. If you have thoughts on recent episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, recent weird houses, recent artifacts, or older episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, ideas for future episodes, all of that is on the table. In the meantime, if you want to check out any of these various episodes, you can find the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. A quick way to get to it is to go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, and that will send you to the iHeart listing for our page. And if you go there, you can also click on the store, and that'll take you to a place. Well, we have like a TeePublic shop where you can buy some logos on T-shirts and stickers and whatnot. So, you know, that's kind of fun. Check it out if you want.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.